Well, hello, Healthcare Experience Matters listeners. Your host, Casey Callanan, is back for today's episode that I'm really excited about. We're talking with Catherine Richards-Golini. She is a PhD and a healthcare editor with Karger Publishers and a plain language expert, which when you're talking about educating patients and making sure they understand disease states and all that type of thing, could not be more important in this age of the internet and artificial intelligence. So I am so excited to have her join us for that discussion. And I'll step aside here, let her introduce herself and tell us a little bit more about her background.
Thank you, Casey. Thank you for inviting me on today. I'm a healthcare publications editor at Karger. We're a Swiss medical publisher. We also have a unit that produces books for healthcare professionals and books for patients and other resources for patients. And that's where you find me, mostly responsible for the patient resources. Prior to coming into publishing, actually, I was a teacher for years and years and years, way too many years. And I gradually got into medical English and realized I really liked the medical staff, and was often horrified at the way my trainee nurses and radiographers were role-playing their conversations with patients. And I was often thinking, wow, you don't have much respect for these patients, do you? So gradually I shifted careers and I did a PhD in applied linguistics, and I looked at medical writing, medical resources in radiography, and did some kind of lexical analysis on those things and discovered that they really were hard to read, which we knew anyway, and then moved into publishing, where you find me today.
And I want to ask a follow-up to what you just made mention of with the role-playing situation. What was that about? What kind of errors were you uncovering? Just people listening can kind of understand what, from your perspective, was wrong with those role-playing scenarios.
Yeah, I think what it often came down to, Casey, was that my students, who had very competent English speakers, and they were using English with non-native Italian speakers, because I live in an Italian region of Switzerland, and they often came into contact with people who didn't speak Italian, and English was the common language. So they would be role-playing in English. That was my job, to teach them how to do that, among other things. And often it was the way that they would manhandle the patient or the person playing the patient in the role play. They'd be pushing and shoving. And when communication broke down, there was no effort to actually build it up again with words. But simply the first response would be to take the patient and to push them towards the X-ray bed or whatever. And in my experience here as a patient, that's exactly what happens as well in the real world. So, and it's not nice, is it? Anyone listening knows if that's happened to you, that's not a nice experience to be manhandled by a complete stranger.
Definitely. And what is some sort of takeaway that you see as maybe the most salient thing that people tend to do and overlook when you're talking about communicating with patients? Is there something that you see recurring and you're like, well, this is actually somewhat of an easy fix? I would just recommend doing this. Is there anything that jumps out to you about that question?
Well, I think one thing is always listening to the patient. Now, I know that if there are any healthcare professionals listening to this podcast, they might immediately say, well, hey, do you know how many minutes I've got to deal with patients? I don't have time to listen to the patient. So perhaps it's not an easy fix, Casey, but it seems to be an easier fix than some of the other things we could do. And that's training students of any healthcare professional. It doesn't matter if they're a nurse, a doctor, a radiographer, anyone who comes into contact with patients. They need to be trained how to communicate with patients. And it rarely gets done. Nurses do a lot more of it, of course. But even today, I know that there are medical schools who don't teach their medical students medical communication. And we've got doctors coming out with their qualifications being unable to effectively speak. And then, of course, if you feel that you can't speak properly, you're not being understood, you don't know how to approach it, it must be very frustrating for a doctor in that scenario. And the first, perhaps the easiest thing to do is to manhandle and to not communicate, to shut down, and to not say what perhaps needs to be said.
Tell me about the use of jargon and assuming knowledge. I know that, you know, I'm guilty of it when I'm talking about things that I'm an expert in, you know, media, podcasting, even all that type of thing. You know, I just feel like it's nothing intentionally wrong that people are doing. It's just, you're so in the weeds of that subject matter that sometimes it's, you just are assuming knowledge. So tell me about kind of some of the mistakes you're seeing with people that are using jargon, assuming knowledge. Yeah. And then I'm curious about what kind of like reading level you think, you know, is safest to try to reach when talking with patients.
Yeah, you've hit the nail on the head there. Jargon, and we're all guilty of it. You might be a great cook and you might know your way around all the ingredients and the equipment in your kitchen, but if somebody has never cooked an omelet in their life, they'll have trouble following you as you passionately explain your latest recipe. So yeah, this is a huge problem. I find when I'm writing the patient books, I don't always write them. We often use medical writers, sometimes I do. I find that I'm writing at a higher level sometimes than I know that I should be. So I have to go back over that sentence and read it with different eyes. And it is difficult to put yourself in the position of not knowing. This is why I do sympathize with healthcare professionals who have difficulty communicating with their patients. The amount of knowledge a healthcare professional brings to their job, it's very, very difficult to imagine, to remember how it was when they were 14 years of age and had little medical knowledge. But that's what most patients are. We know about medicine, but the average person struggles with understanding where certain organs are located in the body. So it's no good talking about a spleen without explaining where it is. Giving them a picture. You know, we've got to go right back to basics. You can easily lose a reader for the patient books or a patient. You can lose them in a matter of seconds by assuming knowledge. And I mean, there are readability standards. Your second question referred to readability, didn't it? And of course, there are standards in the United States and in the United Kingdom, and I believe in Australia as well. We, for booklets, which are sort of 50-page booklets, I can even flash one up on the screen here. They're these kind of things. We aim for, now I'm not going to get confused with grades and school age here, but I'm going to say an age between 12 and 14. I don't know what grade that would be where you are. Well, I don't even know what that would be in England. I suppose second or third year secondary school, whatever that means to you. I don't know.
It would be probably just about sixth grade. Sixth to seventh and eighth grade, yeah.
And, you know, people who don't know about this stuff, of course, immediately, I do stuff sometimes feel that people get a bit defensive about this and say, well, yeah, that's childish. Well, no, it's not, because actually the average 14-year-old can read pretty well. it's not about dumbing anything down. It's about not confusing people. It's about presenting complex information in a way that doesn't confuse the reader. With the information sheets, which tend to be two-page, two-side information sheets, we like to think of them being useful when people have just diagnosed and perhaps they've gone home and possibly in a state of shock. The reading age is lower, and we aim for a sort of 9-year-old elementary school, I suppose, reading age, because it's the basic information, just the basic information. What is this? Is there a cure? What's going to happen next? Is there treatment?
And I want to know about how artificial intelligence and technology has, you know, complicated this conversation. I know that we rely a lot on Google research and all that type of thing. That's been around obviously for a while, but now with the kind of proliferation of more AI tools, does that complicate this conversation today? Does it make it in any way better? I mean, maybe some ways it's helpful to be a check and balance on maybe the way we communicate with patients, but I'm really curious about that.
Yeah. I think it's too soon to tell, to be honest. I think there are things that we're clearer about with AI. in terms of writing for patients, well, look, I've experimented with it. Of course I have. I'd be foolish not to. And I do find it fascinating. And certainly my basic experimentation with ChatGPT told me that it perfectly understands if I say make it suitable for patients. AI can deal with that lexical shift, if you like. However, punto, 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 as we say in Italian, point, point, point. However, there's a lot of research happening at the moment. And I've just come back from the ISMAP conference in London, International Society of Medical Publication Professionals. They've got a European branch. And I was at their conference in January. And I would say 50% of all the sessions concerned AI. There is an issue with the vast disparity of output from all the different AI platforms. They're not all doing the same thing. They're not all producing the same quality, if you like. And I was part of a small study. I was asked if I wanted to be part of it. I did, because it fascinates me, to have a look at stakeholder appraisals, reviews of two plain language summaries produced by a range of different AI platforms. So on the one hand, it was very interesting to see the differences between these AI platforms, given the paper, there were two papers. I forget now what the topics were, orthopedics, and I forget what the other one was, given the paper and asked to produce a PLS. And it was quite fascinating how different they could be. And really, some of them were dreadful. Some of them were terrible. Some of them were really quite good. But it was also interesting to see how the different stakeholders responded to the output. And the stakeholders included authors of the original paper, people like myself, patient advocates, popular science editors. Perhaps I was put into that category, I don't know, and scientific editors. And we, in some cases, patient advocates were responding in a different manner to some of the outputs. And that, I found that fascinating. And I think we might go on and do a second study to investigate that a little further. So I think, yeah, the jury's out there, Casey, what it will bring for patient resources. I think certainly for short, plain language summaries, these are already being produced by AI and they're doing a reasonable job, right? Anything longer, anything more complex, I don't think we're there yet, but it won't be long, probably.
Yeah, this has been a great discussion. And I want to ask about something you mentioned towards the beginning of this podcast, and that's the multilingual setting, patients in the multilingual setting. I know we've had an episode of this podcast that I'll link to in the description of this episode, where I interviewed a person on this subject matter who was working in a New York City hospital that had a lot of different languages being spoken. You're in a part of the region where there's multiple languages being spoken. Just talk to me about that whole, you know, complicated situation where there are multiple languages being spoken within one institution and how to navigate that.
Yeah. And I would imagine in a city like New York or London, of course, which is another hugely multicultural city, this can be hugely problematic, particularly in the A&E, the ER setting. I think here in Switzerland, to be honest with you, most healthcare personnel have enough English or enough of the other native language here in Switzerland, German or French, to manage. I think the complexity comes when you're in a city like New York, or as I said, London or Paris, any of these big cities, where you've got residents who don't speak the local language, but they come from all over the world. And of course, you're going to have tourist patient traffic as well. But the residents who live in our cities, who's perhaps because of their generation, perhaps they're the older residents, they're speaking their native tongue at home, they've never really got a handle on English. And then you're faced with translation problems, aren't you? And that's an interesting area. I don't know a huge amount about it, except to know that it's fraught with difficulty because, firstly, you've got to pay translators. And if city councils or hospital systems or whoever are not willing to pay them, you've got to find them for all those languages that are obscure. and that's not always easy. You end up relying on family translators or, you know, the guy down in the pathology department who you think speaks the same language, and you give him a buzz to come up. That's, you know, that happens. We know it happens, and it's hugely problematic.
Yeah, that is very well said. It is a very complicated issue. I'll, like I said, link to the episode for people that want to check that out. Really, I appreciate your response to that. And I always like to give a chance for our guests to leave us with any final thoughts. If there's anything that I missed asking about that you wanted to make mention of, please go ahead now and do so.
Well, firstly, your questions have been great because you've really covered all sorts of areas that I find interesting. Sometimes I'm asked just about plain language summaries or just about AI, and you've covered a lot of different topics, which is great because I love talking about this stuff. I was thinking of something earlier when I was getting ready for this interview, Casey, and I was thinking there's a lot of talk about misinformation at the moment, right? Misinformation on the internet, and we've got to make sure that people aren't misinformed. And I think I totally agree that we've got to make sure that people are not misinformed. But I do wish that we paid as much attention to raising health literacy standards as we do to the fear that people might be misinformed on some patient forum somewhere. Health literacy should be everybody's responsibility, and it should be taught in our schools. It should be taught at elementary school. It isn't, as far as I'm aware, it isn't. But if we pay just a fraction of the attention to that, to raising standards and raising levels of health literacy, we perhaps wouldn't be faced with the fear of misinformation. That's probably not what you expected me to say.
No, that's a great way to put a bow on this conversation for today. I think I'd love to have you come back on and dive deep on some of these topics even more.
It'd be a pleasure.
This has been an amazing conversation. I want to thank you for making time for the Healthcare Experience Matters podcast today. Our guest has been Catherine Richards-Golini. She is a healthcare editor with Karger Publishers, and she is a plain language consultant, as you can tell. Very, very great conversation here today. And I, again, just want to thank you for your time.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of Healthcare Experience Matters. Healthcare Experience Matters is brought to you by the Healthcare Experience Foundation. To learn more, please visit healthcareexperience.org. That's healthcareexperience.org.